from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Actress Connie Nielsen first entered the Hollywood spotlight with a role in Ridley Scott's Gladiator and went on to win awards for her role in Brothers. She joins us in this segment to discuss her career, including her appearance in Lars von Trier's controversial Nymphomaniac, and she's a Marin resident. We'll also talk with her about being a woman of a certain age in Hollywood and about her humanitarian aid project in Kibera, Kenya. Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you so much.
I had mentioned to Connie before we went on the air that I was at a party with some friends, and there were some guys there who were working with her in Kibera, Kenya, who were extolling not only the work that she's done there and that she's supported, but also just the nature of the work and the nature of her involvement in it. And we'll get into that. But first, I thought we'd talk about your career, because I've been reading some things about just your response to being an actress. I think it's maybe more politically correct to say an actor now than an
actor. That's right, yeah.
But you said it's an extraordinarily healthy profession, and I was struck by that because a lot of people don't think that. But you were speaking personally. You were saying it's made you more empathic, it's helped you avoid depression, all kinds of positive things.
I feel that the whole point of being an actor is that you put yourself in other people's places. And so that's what I meant. It makes you empathic because you constantly have to put yourself into the place of even bad people. Like, you know, when you play an evil person, such as the various characters I've done where I've played a negative person, I had to put myself into the ideas and thoughts about why is she this way? What made her like this? And then care for her, even while she was doing terrible things.
Even those diabolical figures you wind up caring for, or at least having compassion and understanding for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this expands your consciousness. Of course, you began, I know you went to Paris to become an actor at about the age of 18, but you were also a singer and a dancer.
That's
still
right.
Still are?
Yeah, yeah. You know, in my bathtub, you know.
In your bathtub, you dance?
Well, maybe that's not so much dancing, but certainly love dancing, love singing, and love acting, yes.
And talking about you going to France, you're actually in a Jerry Lewis comedy. He still is very popular in France, which mystifies some people, but your real breakthrough, I guess, was The Devil's Advocate, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was the first sort of, it was also the first experience on set that kind of blew my mind. You know, you walk on set and there's Al Pacino and you're playing his daughter. It's an experience.
Actually, you mentioned Al Pacino because when Billy Friedkin, who I know you worked with among many other directors, was on here, he was talking about how difficult it was to work with Al Pacino from a director's standpoint. And I don't know if we want to get into that kind of thing here, but you've worked with some people who are certainly known, Pacino being one, Russell Crowe in Gladiator, where you really established a reputation. No one is being difficult.
I have to say that my experience with both Al and with Russell were fantastic, and I could not speak more highly about them in terms of collaboration, giving space for an actor, and just being such amazing, honest actors. You cannot but be blown away by what's happening in the scene in front of you, and it just grabs you and just sends you into this alternate reality, and it's a fantastic.
So you don't want to talk about who is difficult to work with?
Well, you know, there are lots of people who are difficult, certainly directors can be difficult. So
we don't necessarily have to name names, but I mentioned Gladiator, and that really, really had an enormous effect on your career. I mean, launching in terms of awards and recognition and so forth, it was key.
Well, it's interesting. They're talking about Ridley Scott as obviously an incredible director, but also here, incredibly collaborative, supportive, a real mensch, and just someone who is insatiably curious and who has the most wonderful disposition on set as well. I could not be more in admiration of a director than of Ridley.
It's interesting to hear you speak in all these favorable and positive ways, because you've also spoken out about all the cliches in so many of the movies that we see. And you've said on a couple of occasions, I think, that Hollywood tries to dumb down too much. It's much more bankable.
Well, I think they think that it's much more bankable, but I don't agree with that assessment. And I also think that film history has proven again and again that the big audience completely can relate to very difficult and very complex issues. It's really a question of how you present them and how good you are at it. And I think that the reasons for making certain movies with certain people, with certain content, I still find mystifying. Certainly that's the kind of stuff that I'm speaking out against. Also, in those particular types of movies, there you find that women's roles are as diminished in that type of consciousness as are, you know, the complexity of issues.
Much more cliched roles for women, and difficult for women as they advance in age to get not only non-cliché roles, but roles that are substantial. Yeah.
And here I have to say, this has changed a lot, not least because TV has become this creative explosion. There is this new age of creativity in filmmaking, and it's oddly enough happening to a large degree in television.
You're talking about like Showtime and HBO and all that?
And even Amazon and Netflix, you know, all these new content providers, or shall we say distributors, have now become content providers, and they are making interesting content. And it is intelligent content, and it's content that acknowledges that the majority of the people who are choosing what to watch are women, and therefore they cannot continue to serve women what they do not want to see. They want to be in on the game of getting this kind of public. Well, they got to serve that public in an intelligent and respectful manner, and that's what they're doing.
Well, you've played some important roles in television. You were Detective Danielle Beck on Special Victims Unit. You were in The Following, in The Boss opposite Kelsey Grammer. I've had a lot of experience with The Good Wife now, and you like doing TV, or you prefer doing film, or is there a preference?
Yeah, I really think there's not a preference. It really depends on the project. It has to be, obviously, very smart. I have to be emotionally moved by it. I have to be intellectually tickled by it. And
TV can do that.
And TV can do that.
Yeah, well, it's refreshing to hear, you know, because there's still the notion that Newton Menno, in his speech about that vast wasteland and television being that vast wasteland, you're here to tell us otherwise.
That's right. And I think, you know, everybody who is watching, real TV will tell you that, you know, you go in and you watch some of these things. Most of your friends will tell, oh, I've been binge watching this and binge watching that, because there is so much interesting stuff going on.
Talking to Connie Nielsen, actress and, as I said, also activist, and we're going to talk about the work that she's done in just a moment. I wanted to also really explore with you some comments you made about how you're talking about the importance of film and television, you know, reaching out and actually having effect on people, the effect it has on you as a professional actor. But also, you say you prefer chaos to order. What do you mean by that?
I just mean that creativity, I think, is very important in our lives. And I feel that creativity is somewhat related to chaos. It's the idea that there's something disruptive, something that is not a schematic process, but instead is open to chance, to love, to a lot of important energies that are not necessarily linear. And in that, I am invariably drawn towards that.
And does Lars von Trier fit into this idea of
disruption?
Chaos?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, we were talking about the film Nymphomaniac. I saw Mick LaSalle, our local film critic, called it one of the worst movies of the year. And I was going back and rereading some of that stuff about the Cannes Film Festival, mm-hmm. when he caused a big...
Yes.
Well,
yes.
He said, I'm a Nazi, and I
no, no, he did
Hitler.
Not say that. But he was making a terrible, terrible, terrible joke. And I'm not here to be, defender of Lars von Trier. He is very capable of doing that himself. But I do know the background to that story, and it was a bad joke between two directors.
Well, he apologized, and then he retracted the apology.
Well, because, you know, I think he felt that it was dishonest. But certainly, you know, I don't want to get into that whole problem because I wasn't even there. I just want to say I do know the background to this. And, you know, it's also important to know that Lars grew up as a Jewish person. So it's really important to understand that he did not mean to offend anyone. I do agree that it was in poor taste. But
were you glad you weren't Kirsten Dunst?
I'm sorry. I'm very happy I wasn't there.
Yeah, she was the one who had to answer for all that. Again, if you've just joined us, we're talking to actor Connie Nielsen, who actually lives in Marin and drives bike rides under the Golden Gate Bridge and
Absolutely.
Take advantage of living out here and love it.
Love it. Absolutely love it. It is an amazing lifestyle out here in San Francisco. And the kind of deep connection that one has to nature here and to the actual landscape and land that we're living on is unique to America. So far, I've not met another place that has this type of lifestyle. And I absolutely love and adore it.
And apropos, perhaps, of your love of chaos, you moved here because of your relationship with Lars von Ulrich?
That would be very correct.
And that was how many years
ago? The part of moving here because of Lars, yes.
Well, he, for those who don't know, is a drummer with Metallica. And one does associate that music perhaps with a kind of chaos, even though people certainly have...
Yeah, I would call it the opposite. I think it's very linear, in fact.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, you said your favorite... I was reading some information where you said your favorite band is The Clash.
Yeah.
How does
Back
that
to Disruption.
Yeah, well, there were more with Disruption. That was okay with Lars during the time?
You know, I think he wasn't expecting me to be his biggest fan. You know, in terms of music, he was expecting me to be his biggest fan in terms of, you know, our private lives, yeah.
And I also mentioned that you love sunglasses when you came in here and wore up. You have a couple hundred pair of designer sunglasses?
Yeah.
It's a hobby, I guess.
Well, you know, it's just it's more sort of like an impulse than a hobby.
Well, let's talk about something that is really a wonderful impulse, and that's the work that you've been doing in Kibera, and particularly in Kenya, where Kibera is located. It's actually southwest of Nairobi. And like I said, I was having to be talking to some guys at a party, and they said, you know Connie Nielsen and Karina Ryan and her significant other, Steve Silverstein, were there, and she's also Danish. And I said, well, this is someone you really should know, Michael, because of the work that she's doing. These guys were talking about this work as well. This is a project that really began with trying to get water and trying to get sanitation to this area, which are both dire needs, to put it mildly.
Well, you're talking about a space that is in the middle of Nairobi, which is, to people who don't know it, one of Africa's most cosmopolitan and technically advanced cities. And yet there are hundreds of thousands, some people say a million, people living in this large slum called Kibera in practically the center of Nairobi. And I was struck when I went there. I was shooting a movie there, in fact, about slum people when I, in 2010, got to know people who live in a place like that. I'd never met anyone living in an informal settlement before. Here, as the magic is with movies, I got to know people who are slum dwellers in a very personal way because they were actors on my film. They were the crew members. They were my security detail. There were all of these different people. And I went around meeting their families and coming into their homes and being received with an enormous amount of graciousness. I also saw an incredible level of professionalism and talent. And it is striking to walk through a place like that and meet people who are as deft with a cell phone as you are, if not more, and as deft with their words and with their talents, whether that be musical or poetry or painters, and of course technical people as well.
Amazing. You kind of fell in love with them.
I was stunned that because I met the reality of the real true face of poverty. Real true face of poverty is that it's an obscenity because people living there are nothing unlike you and me. They are exactly the same with one crucial
without running
difference.
Water or electricity in so many cases.
Well, yeah. They have no access to any of the services that allow us to express who we are. And therefore, they're also sitting with all of this talent and all of this knowledge and capacity and being forced to have it implode on themselves. That is inhuman. I find this type of extreme poverty inhuman, and we create a human needs project in direct response and recognition of the innate talent and ability of every human being on this planet, and we are working to ensure that they, in Kibera and hopefully in the future in many other informal settlements, that we allow a space where people can go and have access to communications, to networks, to education, to information about their health, and to hope. Clean water and showers and toilets are just the basic building blocks of human dignity and health. in addition to that, we're making sure that their other part, their human, their soul, is having the ability to express itself through these centers that allow them to access services that they need in order to do so.
Well, they've done an enormous amount there, I know. And in fact, as far as we can quantify these things, there was a point in Kibera, I know, where 20% of the children were really doomed to die of either cholera or...
Before the age of five,
or malaria or diarrhea and so forth. And to what extent have we reduced that now?
Well, so it's not just access to water. We need to get into another issue. Like right now, researchers are realizing what should have been evident, but it's hard to quibble with what, you know, we know and what we don't know at any given time. We only know what we know. But what people have figured out so far is that the real problem is also sanitation, that, you know, when you see undernourished children, it's not just because they're not getting enough food. It's that their bodies are unable to absorb the nutrients they are getting because they're so busy fighting off diseases.
Well, two thoughts come to mind. I mean, I remember reading an interview with you where you said food is medicine. So there's that side of it. But also there are these flying toilets. I mean, they actually take what they excrete and they put it in bags and then they just dispose of it. I don't want to get too scatological.
It flies, at night and then it lands wherever it lands. And then the next morning, children play on it and get sick.
Terrible sanitation problem.
It's a terrible sanitation problem. We need to not, if we were living in the same difficulty of sanitation, and you have to imagine hundreds of thousands of people crammed together in a very, very small and finite amount of space, and they are all being forced to try to regulate their bowel movements when they are also sick. I mean, there are sometimes insurmountable difficulties to actually going and finding a toilet. So this is not just, you know, a problem of a costume, you know, or like a coutume, I don't know how you say that, of habit and of culture. On the contrary, people want to have a toilet, but they're often difficult to reach. And imagine if you had to pay a certain amount of your very meager income just to do that.
So you want to expand this. You want to go global with this.
Yes.
That's really ambitious and wonderful. I'm also struck by the fact that you were hesitant on a word there. How many languages do you speak?
I speak seven. But one of the things that are really important to us is that this project also becomes self-sustainable. And we believe that the sustainability of the project itself is part of changing the way in which we are doing development and the way in which we are supporting other peoples. We call it buy-in. We need skin in the game from the people that we're helping and that they, in order to respect themselves and respect us, they need to buy into it too, and they need to pay for their services at a market rate, at a market cost that they can afford.
People can find out more by going to your website?
That's
the website,
right.
Of Give It.
Human Needs Project. So www.humanneedsproject.org. You can also read about us on many, many, many different Facebook, on Web 2.0, our Twitter, our Instagram. We're proud to be available for social media as well.
It's nice to hear www if we haven't heard in a while. By the way, let me invite those of you who are listening to join us with Connie Nielsen. We've got a little more time with her, and you may want to talk to her about her career or about what she's outlined for us and highlighted as the work that she's been doing in Kenya. And you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program and any questions or comments you might have for Connie Nielsen. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And we also welcome your Twitter tweets. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Already some questions are coming in about the career, naturally. Here's Jim, who writes, Gladiator is, in my opinion, one of the most powerful movies ever made. Your impact and contribution to the film's success could not be overstated. What was it like to work with Ridley Scott? Well, you've said somewhat what you felt about that, but he says, I'd love to hear anything you're willing to share about the most, he calls him, visionary director of all time.
I can tell you guys about, we had a rewrite, and there was a lot of stuff that was put into the rewrite that was anachronistic and did not really fit with the film, and I was a little bit disappointed, and I tried not to really voice it, but he sensed, Ridley sensed my hesitation on the phone and asked me to send my comments, send my my insights from my research, just absolutely asked me to bring everything to the table that I had. That's the kind of director he is, somebody who is very inclusive and very sensitive director towards actors' needs. He would oftentimes not dress the set, not say where, say, the furniture was on set until we had done a rehearsal, and allowed us basically to say, you know, I'd really love it if I could enter from here rather than from there. That was
it's almost like a stage director.
Yeah, it was incredible that you actually had that type of freedom.
Nobody confuses you anymore with Bridget Nelson.
No.
I mean, early on in the career, but I think she's kind of faded from public eye. Marta writes, I watched Gladiator several times and still am mesmerized by the performance and beauty of Connie Nielsen. She is amazing. And another listener wants to know if you can talk about working with Kevin Costner. I guess 3 Days to Kill was the movie. Yeah?
That's right. Well, first of all, I absolutely adore Kevin Costner. He is a real wonderful man. He's a family man. He is...
I was thought you could say mensch again and ask you if you speak yes. Yiddish among these people.
He is a family man. He is a kind man, and he is a great actor, and we had a lot of fun. He is also really funny. Really great guy. Could not say more nice stuff.
You don't think of him as a funny guy, though, usually.
Right, exactly. But he is really funny. He has like a really great sense of humor.
Let me go to some calls, and we begin, Naveen, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Go ahead.
My comment was really just, I lived in Nairobi for about 5 months, and I saw a lot of people who would come in from an outsider's perspective with the goal of changing things. And I visited Kibera, and the problem that most people had was that of sustainability. How do you create a solution that is dependent only upon you or largely upon you? How do you create something that's more lasting? That was just what I was trying to learn, and I'll take my response off there.
Okay, thank you for the question, Connie Nielsen.
I think this is a great question, and basically, I know that there are informal figures that are saying that $1 billion has been poured into Kibera, and yet you still only see mud huts and corrugated iron. And
the government is doing almost nothing, really.
I think it's difficult. So we had a real breakthrough. We formed a community cooperating committee. We call them the 3 C's. It's formed of elders, and it's formed of one elected representative of all of the community-based organizations on the ground. So all of the people who live there in that particular part of Kibera that we're working in. Another issue that people also don't take into account is literally shoddy construction, very bad construction. We put everything in on making the construction solid, basing ourselves on our own clean technology and making the entire center completely autonomous, free of any support systems anywhere. And I think that the idea of creating autonomy while at the same time integrating into our project and into its management only people from the community. So yes, loads and loads of scientists, loads and loads of technical people who knew a lot about a lot of things without which we would not have been able to create this technological marvel. But on the other hand, completely grassroots based. We've educated 30 young people, half men, half women, from all of the different tribes that are in the community. And we have taught one of the most important things that we taught in our education over those 2 years was self-leadership, because the self-leadership was part of learning how to see yourself, how you see yourself and how you see the world, giving the young men and women of our community in Kibera the ability to change out of whatever was holding them back from accepting and being tolerant of different tribals, communities, different religions, and for example, of women.
Really trying to give a lot of agency and autonomy here, too, a lot of sense of independence and all that. What I was struck by when I first heard about the project from these people who've been involved working with you is just the technology. I mean, getting it there.
Yeah. I mean, we have amazing professors, designers. I mean, we have Professor Daniel Kam, and we have John Gage. We have Ken Cow, the incredible clean technology designer. We have, of course, my inimitable and amazing partner, David Warner, who is the leader of Red Horse Constructors, who is, you know, one of the foremost green builders in California. So, you know, the type of knowledge that is inherent on our board and in our entire group of consultants is extraordinary. But without the actual work on the ground on providing education, information, and self-determination, is without that, none of it would have worked.
You were talking about how acting expanded your consciousness, made you more empathic, more commiserative, all of those kinds of things. And yet, this has been a different kind of task in terms of not only empathy, obviously, and the sense of what you described as a universal nature of perhaps humanity and your connectedness to it. But what I'm struck by is also all of the technological and minute even kinds of things that you had to become conversant with and had to learn.
Yes. I mean, we had to, for example, invent our own wastewater management system. There are no sewers. There's no sewer system to hook up to. So we had a lot of very smart people look at how to create a wastewater management system that could recycle 16,000 gallons of wastewater every day. Well, I mean, I had to learn what they were talking about in order to be able to say, you know, do I think this is a great idea or not? And again, David Warner was a fantastic teacher and made me understand exactly what it is that happens in the different chambers of our system. And wonderful, just wonderful.
Another comment about your work. This is a listener named Linda who writes, I appreciate you and Kelsey Grammer shedding light on Lewy body dementia, the second most prevalent type of dementia, on the Showtime production of Boss. I mean, we should change those antecedents around a little bit, but we think we know what she means. Your portrayal of the mayor's wife was frighteningly good, and I loathed and empathized with her at the same time. Thank you for your outstanding work.
Thank you.
What about, though, getting back to Lars von Trier for just a moment. No, I mean, what was your sense of wanting to be involved in a movie like that? And what about, for example, maybe what your kids would think of a movie like that?
I believe that disruption is part of the job and duty of the artists in our community. We believe we must, as a group of people, continue to put question marks at what it is we're doing. Question what it is we're doing. Lars was doing a very brave thing. He was saying, we are obviously still having very difficult, we are having a difficulty around explaining and expressing sexuality. And in this case, he's going towards what is the most the repressed sexuality of women. They're either, you know, virgins or they're porn stars. You know, those two types of sexuality, denial of sexuality or exploitation of sexuality, those two are allowed, but it still is to a large degree in cinema.
So he was doing something about that whole dichotomy, the Madonna and the whore thing and all that.
That, you know? Yes, but also looking into what type of person needs to be hurt all the time, for example. That is disruptive. I don't care if he was interested in the sexual life of ants. To me, the fact that he's willing to go that far to explore a subject matter, I want to support that.
Well, if he's interested in the sexual life of ants, he'd be working with Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson. Connie Nielsen, thank you. Pleasure to have you here with us. And again, she's co-founder of the Human Needs Project, which provides clean water to residents of Kibera, Kenya. And you can see her on multiple media, television, film, etc. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.